Hello, everyone, and welcome to Season 2 of APIs Unplugged. My name is Matt McClarty. I'm the global leader of API strategy for MuleSoft, and I'm delighted to have you join us in our second season in this calendar year 2021. We made it through 2020, and it's great to have you here. As always, I'm extremely pleased to be joined by Mr. Mike Amundson. Mike, what's going on?
Hey, it's great to be here. We, like you said, we made it to 2021. Fantastic first season. There's so many things I enjoyed so much talking to you about. So I'm looking forward to the new year and starting off with this episode. So let's go.
Awesome. And for anyone who's new to this podcast, we did our last episode in season one was a complete retrospective, which had highlights of all the awesome guests that we had. I encourage you to listen to that one if you haven't listened before, and then that'll just get you hooked and you'll want to go listen to all the season one. But it's a whole new season ahead, and we're totally excited to have our first guest right off the bat, David Berland, who is a longtime collaborator for Mike and myself. He is the editor-in-chief of Programmable Web, and we're going to do something a little different on this episode with the three of us. But first, I would love for David to tell us about your whole background in the API space.
Hey, guys. First of all, thank you for having me. Happy New Year to you guys.
Happy New Year.
You bet.
I agree. We made it through 2020, but I would say maybe just barely. it's great to be here. And just real briefly, I've been a tech journalist for a long time, and somewhere in that journey, I was at a after hours party in San Francisco for some event, and I stumbled across these two people, one from Yahoo and one from Google, talking about this thing called web APIs. And I was like, what are you talking about? And nothing had been launched at that point yet, but they were both talking. The Google guy was talking about the launch of the Google Maps API. And the person from Yahoo was talking about the launch of the Flickr API, for those of you who remember Flickr. And as they described this, my head just exploded. And I was like, what? Like you're going to turn the web into an operating system? Just like, your desktop has a bunch of APIs, only these are going to have like real business value? That's crazy. That's going to change everything. And the time I was working for CNET, and I went back to CNET and I said, hey, guys, this is going to be the biggest thing since sliced bread, and there's no event for it where we can go as reporters and learn and just stay on top of it. Let's start the event. And they looked at me and said, Dave, thanks very much, but we just don't do events. And I said,
they were ahead of their time.
Yeah. And really. And so I said, well, could I do the event? Like, would you mind if I just did it myself, on the side? And they said, sure, David, as long as it doesn't interfere with your day job. And within a couple months, we ran the first API event in the world. We called it Mashup Camp. It was a real great community event. I don't know if you remember that. It was back in February of 2006. And from there, we ran a whole bunch of them all over the world. And so I got really tied into all the API providers and, everybody who's innovating in the world of web APIs, met John Musser, who founded Programmable Web. And and then over the years, just kept reporting on this and eventually ended up as the editor-in-chief of Programmable Web. So here I am.
All right. Fantastic. Yeah, it's quite a journey, right? Like some of these things feels like yesterday, and then you think about the time that's passed. But you're right from the beginning. So I think that, like I'm thinking February 2006. I was working at a bank, so I can't say I was in the exciting event world of Silicon Valley then. But I think we've all had our paths into the API community, API economy.
Yeah,
and so we're gonna get into kind of the API economy in a minute, but let me talk a little bit about the format we want to do here today. So last year we opened our new podcast by making predictions I think. We're talking about the hot trends.
Yep.
So the predictions are always wrong, right? Like we missed the pandemic. You know,
shame on me.
That kind of changed things for the whole year. But rather than try and make predictions, what we want to do to open season two is ask some provocative questions about the API space. So that's why I think David, with your background and expertise, you're a perfect guest for this. And I think we all have lots of opinions. So what we're gonna do is we're each going to ask each other person one provocative question to really think about the kind of what we're seeing in the industry right now. So we'll kind of go around. It's kind of like a round table, passing the baton. So first question, question number one, I'm going to ask to David. So, we just talked about this kind of history of the API economy, and we've definitely, having been on the journey for a while, not quite as long as you in the open API space, but we've seen this promise from the beginning. Like you said, you saw it as you could foresee just what a massive impact it would have on probably the business world, society, everything. And we always, as proponents of that, we always talk up the business value of APIs and this power of the API economy and with good reason. But I think as it matures, we're starting to see more, start to come into focus some of the more bigger risks that are happening out there. So you just published a great article, which, by the way, I can now add the word exfiltration to my vocabulary. And I hadn't really thought of that before. But talking about the Parler, recent shutdown of the Parler social network and, all the political implications, the whole other side of the API economy. But I think in a broader context, that kind of highlights some of the risk areas. So, really, what are the lessons that in general people who are getting into the API game can learn from that whole Parler experience?
Yeah, and maybe just we'll do a brief rundown of the order of events and then what led us at Programmable Web, mm-hmm. given our focus on APIs there, to write this story. As everybody knows, on January 6th, there was a terrible series of events that took place in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. Angry mob, stormed the Capitol building. And in the wake of that, a lot of the technology companies that were in some way, shape, or form supporting Parler, providing technology to Parler.com, immediately reevaluated whether they should continue to provide that support or not. And for those who don't know what Parler is or was, Parler was that alternative social network, an alternative like Facebook, Instagram, et cetera, mm-hmm. That promised a sort of censor-free zone for people to discuss their thoughts, their political inclinations, and to share their plans. What ended up happening is where their plans for violence, mm-hmm. on the day of January 6th was shared. And so some companies that that provided technology to Parler were one of the darlings of the API economy, Twilio, mm-hmm. Another darling, Amazon Web Services. And in the wake of the riots, these companies decided to tell Parler that they were going to take them down or turn off their service, the provision of services to them based on violations of acceptable use policies. And when word got around that this was going to happen, a bunch of hacktivists decided they were going to try to, as you said, exfiltrate, which is, mm-hmm. retrieve as much of the information that they could pull off of Parler as they could before the takedown was complete. And what was retrieved was something on the order of 57 terabytes of information were public posts, videos, a lot of pictures from that day on January 6th. And the hacktivists, one of their objectives was to get this information because it was evidence of who was involved.
Right.
You know, it was literally like, you know, real time documentation of what happened there and who was involved and the degree to which they were involved. And they saw this as evidence. And I'm sure some law enforcement agencies were interested in this information as well. And very shortly after this started happening, word got around through other various social networks and stuff. And some posts went up that mischaracterized what was happening. They said that people were downloading pictures of driver's licenses of people who had registered to use Parler. They said that because Twilio was involved, the Twilio API was involved, the Twilio API played a role in this illegal annexation of data. There's all kinds of, as you know, you see how these posts go, you know, things, yeah. People stretch the truth in many ways. And so when we saw talk of both the Twilio API and then the API, Parler's own APIs, and what role they might have played in the exfiltration of this data, we were like, we got to do a story on this. You know, did these APIs really play a role? And if they did, what was that role and what could be learned from that? So to set the record straight, Twilio's API had nothing to do with the exfiltration of data. And Twilio did tell Parler they were going to turn off the service to Parler. Parler was relying on Twilio for SMS authentication. For example, if you downloaded the Parler mobile app to your phone and went to activate that, you'd get an SMS code to guarantee that you were a human being and had a real phone and all that. And that was what Twilio was going to take down. And then Parler just discontinued. They just turned it off themselves before Twilio got a chance to take them down. What happened as a result of that is that one of the things these SMS authentication services do is it sort of guarantees you're a human being. And it also throttles the speed at which people can register you. A bot, you know, a big botnet can't come and just like do a million registrations on some website if you have this sort of thing in the way. And so Parler opened themselves up to that by turning off the SMS authentication. But even that had nothing to do with the exfiltration of the data. But something that can be learned from that is that we know, having observed the API economy now for over a decade, that APIs go down. And if you're building a mission critical service and you consider that sort of feature like SMS authentication to be extremely important to what you're doing, to what you're running, your code, you should be engaged with another provider of that capability, and your code should be written in a way that can branch to that other provider in the event that your primary provider goes down or you lose access to them for whatever reasons. It doesn't matter whether it's a takedown due to acceptable use policies or if they just go down and lights go out. It happens.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But Parler had no alternative, and so they had to turn this off. And but again, it had nothing to do with the exfiltration of the data.
Right.
The other thing was that like many websites, you know, Facebook and others, there's an API that's delivering content from the back-end service to the mobile applications. And as it turns out, the way Parler stored its posts and its photos and videos, that part of their API was completely unsecured. So what that means is that all of the public posts, all of the videos, all of the images were freely accessible to anybody who wanted to see them, as long as they knew the URL, you know, path to those assets. And to make matters worse, Parler, instead of randomizing their asset IDs in a way that essentially would randomize those URLs, they used sequential IDs.
Right.
So the first picture was, you know, photo/1, and the second picture was photo/2, and so on. It wasn't even like, you know, coded based on the user who posted it. It was literally that was literally the URL, you know, photo/one/.
It was like a design optimized for exfiltration.
Yeah, right. Design optimized for a bot to do a lot of damage, right? Yeah. And plus, there was no security, zero security on these user URLs, no API key. Not that API keys are a form of security, we all know that by now. But no OAuth authentication, nothing. Just it was as open as you could possibly imagine. And so, when the hacktivists discovered this, the race was on to download as much of the information as they possibly could before Amazon took them down, which Amazon eventually did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so there's a whole bunch of lessons that can be learned from that, which is, you know, how do you design your APIs? How do you design, you know, randomize IDs? How do you secure your APIs? It was really, you know, one of the worst situations of poor API design that we've observed in a really long time. And you know, as word got around about this, you know, a lot of people called it API amateur hour and stuff like that, which I think is a fair characterization.
Well, I think, you know, you point these out in your article, right? That you hit a number of things. You talk about the rate limiting, you talk about the sequential IDs, you talk about the lack of, you know, authentication, even access control, like not just authenticating, but general access control. And one of the things that I think came up so clearly in your version of your piece is that if you're really honest, we all do a lot of these things, right? I think what really became clear in your, as you did the write-up, is it's a cautionary tale for a lot of us, a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of us do this inside a corporate wall, so the threat space is limited. It's like everybody in the company could use the sequential IDs and so on and so forth. But I think it goes all the way back to the stuff we've talked about before, the classic Bezos comment, like treat every API as if it someday is going to be in the public view. So I think it's a great example, like you say, really, of not so best practices, but I think if we're all looking ourselves in the mirror, a lot of us know we can point to this inside our own organization.
Well, you know how this happens, right? I mean, a lot of there was another social network that showed up, I don't know how long ago, and everybody raced to it to see what it was about. I can't even remember the name of it. And but sometimes word gets out, like you start creating something like, and it's MVP, right? You're going to bypass a bunch of the best practices. But then suddenly you have an avalanche, you know, word gets out and you have an avalanche of people come, and now you're just racing to support the scale that you need to support. And a lot of the best practices, we'll get back to that.
Yeah, that's another of the classic anti-patterns, right? Is like the MVP gets released. All of us have kind of learned things. I remember I used to create the ugliest possible MVPs with Times New Roman black text on white screens with no images and, you know, all sorts of, just to make sure that people didn't release the MVP into production, right? But we all know it happens as well. You're exactly right.
Yeah, was it Mastodon? Is that the...
No, Mastodon is another thing. We can
do a whole episode on this, right? I don't know. There have been a few, right? I think... I think it's a cautionary tale from an API design perspective, but also a cautionary tale from an API consumption perspective. Like you pointed out, the dependency management there. And again, I think to Mike's point, everyone's kind of piling on Parler, and I don't personally really mind that, given the broader political context there. But I think it's true. It's like how many. In terms of service equivalence and having your backup, like what if Google Maps goes down or, you know, things like that. Yeah. Obviously, one of the reasons you're going to go with a high-profile API provider is resiliency and so on. But really thinking through the dependency chain, I think it's one of the realities of we get the benefit of, the benefit of scale and the benefit of immediacy of going with these third-party providers so we don't have to build it ourselves. But the trade-off is you've got a dependency there. And if you're, this is an example where maybe, you know, we can generally say ethically the right thing happened based on the incidents and so on. But there could be cases where, you know, maybe you're fine, but for whatever, there's a disagreement with the provider and they decide to pull the plug and they have reasons. You know, you have to manage that risk. So.
In fact, yeah, this risk of losing access to dependent APIs is what slows a lot of businesses into joining the API economy, because it's a big risk. That's how you sort of pose this question, right, Matt? It's like mm-hmm. the risks about APIs, and this is a huge risk. We've seen API organizations close up and create, you know, orphans. So something needs to be done. And I've talked about this in some of my talks in my latest book about the proper way to deprecate, to make things open, to make things available. Other people have talked about this as well. It's just another huge category, the dependency category. And then the other category, which you didn't get to, David, was the privacy category, right? The extra data that's in images that get uploaded and all these other things. There's a best practice to make sure that a lot of this stuff is scrubbed before it's posted to the world. This is another thing they didn't do well. So, you know, downloading the videos and downloading the images didn't just give you the content and the images that could be used by hacktivists, but also the actual, you know, geographic location and time of day and so on and so forth.
Yeah,
that normally isn't available. So there are so many levels. There are so many teaching points for us on privacy, on dependency, on just good design, on all these, you know, throttling and all these other things are all just laid out for us. And if you can get past whatever triggers you have about the content itself or the people who built it, these are great lessons for all of us to make sure we pay attention to. And I think that's one of the key things about your article.
Yeah. And just coming back to the rate limiting point, you know, I mentioned then that just the SMS authentication throttles things to some extent, mm-hmm. but you're correct in that we also identified that there was no rate limiting on the API itself, right? Which gave the hacktivists, you know, it was basically, you know, one of the hacktivists reported that the limitation on how much data she could download was strictly the, you know, the bandwidth of her internet connection.
Yeah.
And then what happened was when she came to realize that she was not going to be able to get all the data in mm-hmm. time, other people jumped in and started mm-hmm. downloading to their, you know, and so, you know, the big lesson is, if you put all of these measures in place, if you kind of rewind and say, what would have happened if they had they had all these measures in place?
Exactly.
The amount of data that would have been retrieved would have been a tiny fraction of what they got.
Exactly. Exactly right. And the quality of the data, the density of the data, and all those things would have been lessened. Yeah. So I think those are the things we all have to pay attention to.
For sure. So great lessons there. Probably maybe the closing thought is I'm kind of glad those measures weren't in place, but we move on.
Matt, I just want to point out, if anybody wants to read that article, I set up a Bitly link. You can just go to bitly.com/parlorapi.
Perfect.
All one word?
Yeah, you know, all one word, all lowercase, okay. And it'll take you right to that article.
Cool. Excellent. All right, David, you are up to ask Mike a provocative question number two.
Okay.
I'm excited.
So I hear a lot of these days, I hear a lot about this idea of low code and no code. Mm-hmm. I hear about this thing called RPA, another acronym, just what we needed, robotic process automation.
Yep.
And I think, you know, going back to my days as a tech journalist, ZDNet and CNET, we have heard forever about this idea that ordinary people are going to be able to use clicks instead of code and just like drag and drop, and the need for developers will go away.
Yep. Yep.
So are we there? What is this idea of low code and RPA? What does it all mean, especially in the context of APIs?
Yeah. So this is a great topic. I love talking about this topic. Low code and RPA. So we can take each of them in turn. Low code. We've always been looking at low code. Like originally, I've told this story a few times. Back in the 80s, I used to code in hex, when I was coding telephone switches, right? So that was low code? Like, it's only hex, you know, I don't have to type so much. But at the same time, what happens is I have to know so much to get started, right? So the way I think about this is it's not just low code, but it's the barrier. How low is the barrier, right? I remember the earliest PCs, like people said, oh, this is crazy. Nobody's going to want to do this. I've heard interviews with Ted Nelson about hypermedia and says, well, that's stupid. Nobody's going to read online where they can just sit in a book in their lap and instead of using a mainframe. Like, things change over time. So we're definitely trying to lower the barrier of entry. And we've gone through cycles of clicks. Like we used to do everything with crazy command keys. Then we did stuff with clicks. Now people are back to using command keys again. Here's the way I think about it. There's this constant battle between who's going to do what that role is in the organization, and how much data they have access to and how much they can manipulate. We used to have typist pools, right? We used to have receptionists in organizations to answer your phone call. A lot of people used to have an administrative assistant to do all your own memos that you would do out every morning. We don't do any of that anymore. We've lowered the barrier and we've used technology for this. We'll keep doing that, and I think we'll do more and more of it. People will sell it as low and no code because it's a good sales pitch, but what they're really doing is selling greater access. You know, spreadsheets were a total mystery 25 years ago. Now they're like boring. So I think on the code side, we're always going to be lowering the barrier, and I think that's important. The way I think about RPA is pretty much the same way. We're living this sort of RPA 2.0 experience. What's 2.0? I'm told 2.0 is this remote process or robotic process access, but we're going to add AI to it, right? So it's going to be really smart, right? So great. Okay, fine. We're actually, all this RPA is some kind of bot or some kind of code that scrapes a screen. We used to call it screen scraping 20 years ago. We're still doing it, and we'll do more of it. Some of it's a terrible idea because what it really means is you didn't really want to spend the time or have the budget to have a real dedicated API or application interface. So you're just going to scrape a screen. Sometimes it's perfect because what we really want to do is we want automation to take things out of our hands. There's a whole bunch of things that become Mechanical Turks. We have our own version. This is me talking. We have our own version in the space of administrative assistants and typist pools and all these other things where programmers and developers and designers are really kind of going through the process of doing things that some of that could have been automated. What we can't automate is the creativity. We can't automate good design. We can't automate quality code. We can't automate the correct match between a customer's, a user's need and the machine. But we can automate parts of it, like DevOps, like testing, and all these other things. So I think we're going to see more and more of that. And to me, they're just different APIs. That's the way I really sum it up. Mm-hmm. Lowering the barrier, automating more, means we have different APIs. That's my take.
When you talk about lowering the barrier, I was thinking while you were talking about what are we lowering the barrier between? Right? Mm-hmm. And I think it aspirationally we should be lowering it between the imagination of the developer and whatever their results are, right? Mm-hmm. Whatever they're producing. Mm. I think my issue with these trends a lot of times is that you lose that focus, right? I particularly pick on RPA a lot because I feel like it's not that it isn't great technology, it's that it can be often used, like you said, to persist problems or to kind of get a bit lazy with, you know, oh, well, we don't really want to do the work to deal with the problems that we created in our tech and the tech, retire the technical debt we have. So let's just put another layer, you know, put some linoleum over the top of what we have. Right. So, but I think that idea, and I know David, the idea of imagination in the tech space is something you've talked about in the past as well. But I think that seems to be, we've got great creativity in, you know, everyone has creative ideas. And so thinking about this as a way to shortcut from your ideas and imagination into what gets produced is a great goal, should be the goal, of these new trends.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, I you really captured the essence of it, I think, Matt. You mentioned developers and their imagination, but I think when you make something available in a low code or no code fashion, let's say an API can be made available in that way. Mm-hmm. What you're doing is you're making the power of the API available to non-developers who have their own imaginations, mm-hmm. And are envisioning some sort of innovation that could be a game changer for the business. Mm. And so, you know, this idea of citizen integration. Mm-hmm. And when I first heard, you know, about citizen integration, you know, in particular in the context of some of the work that MuleSoft is doing around APIs, and the launch of this product or service, if you will, at Dreamforce called Composer, what strikes me about this, or the one thing I realized, was that, you know what, going back to when I was in my, you know, tech journalist in the 90s and you know, at CNET and stuff, you heard a lot about low code or no code development. But in reality, in our world, and this speaks to that idea of, like, you know, their APIs are everywhere, and now they're integral part of, you know, every application that we use, something that you were mentioning earlier, Mike, mm-hmm. Is that the you really can't have an application. You can't put the power of low code application development in the hands of an ordinary person unless you have also the connectivity, easy connectivity to the stuff that's going to be integrated into that application.
Yeah. Right?
Could you imagine just sitting down today and writing some code that doesn't connect to anything? Like, nobody writes those kinds of applications anymore. Right?
Yeah.
Quickly commoditized. Yeah.
Yeah. Every application that gets written, anytime a developer sits down and writes something, they're connecting to an API. So before you can have low code development, you do have to have low code and no code integration, easier citizen grade access to what APIs offer.
Yeah. So that's, you know, you hit on another thing there. What you just really described, picking up on, Matt, is this idea. What we're really talking about when we talk about low is we're talking about access, right? Mm-hmm. Creating better reach, creating access to more people so that more people can add their creative energies to this idea. That the story behind Citizen Integrator is the ability for you to get past administrivia, get past large complicated things, and do something straightforward the way you want to see it right away, right? Which is sort of like that matching up the imagination to the
It's about tools.
Yeah. Yeah. It's about creating better tools, right?
It's, you know, developer is going to have Eclipse in front of them, but somebody who doesn't know how to write code, that's just not going to be the tool for them. So what tool can you put in front of them that gives them that access you're talking about? Access to the same APIs a developer has, but in a way that's easier to kind of drag and drop things.
Absolutely. You know, and that's what Mel Conway has been talking so much about the idea of creating better tooling. I think that is really, really essential. And that sort of leads me, you know, this is sort of another angle on the same story. Matt, it's my job to ask you a provocative question. So this is the one I have for you.
Okay.
And that is this idea of big data and analytics, observability, all that kind of stuff, and AI. We interviewed a lot of people last year that talked a lot about using AI to look at sentiment and content and make decisions. Where do you think that's headed in 2021? I mean, are we in a, like, where are we in the hype cycle for these kinds of things about big data and all that other kind of stuff? Analytics, AI, what do you think?
Yeah, there's a lot there, because to some extent, again, I think AI and the way it's being applied, you know, there's the promise and then there's the application of it, right? And I think that in some ways, we sometimes try to solve unsolvable problems with technology. Like there are probably people out there who think that machine learning can just you know, eliminate the need for human creativity. Well, you know, we can, well, good design. Well, we'll just do a machine learning. We'll just train a model to see what's good design, what's bad design, and then it'll be able to do good design, right? Like, I don't think that's really, we're not there yet. But I think, like, my feeling is there's a lot going on with data assets. And I think it starts with the recognition, something that we focused on a lot last year's podcast, around the idea that data carries this special type of value that makes it almost like currency, that makes it like money. And that the proof point there is that the companies who've been most successful in the digital economy are the ones who've been most effective at monetizing their data, you know, especially through advertising in the case of Google and Facebook. But, you know, look at what Amazon's done for e-commerce and how they've used user collected data and you know, analytics to really drive optimization and user experience and so on. So I think that the treating data as this asset somewhat akin to money, but having special qualities of that we talk about, non-fungibility and non-rivalrous risk and all these other things, I won't go into them here, is where it starts, and why I think that a lot of organizations I'm working with now have this big focus on data. What do we do with it? And a lot of them, it's not about collecting it. It's about just figuring out what to do with the massive amounts of data that they have. I think that there's a whole life cycle around dealing with data. And so I think one of the things that we're seeing now, which has an API angle to it, is that historically this big data has been treated kind of monolithically, started with this idea of heavily curated and structured data warehouses. And then that bottleneck, because it was hard to deal with all the unstructured stuff. So then this came in this notion of data lakes of, hey, just collect it in one spot, you know, get it, doesn't matter what form it's in, just get it all in one place and deal with it there. To the point now where the bottleneck is, okay, it's just too much to have this centralized pool of data. We need to figure out how to use distribution to deal with it. And I think that comes in a lot of different forms. So there's something called data mesh architecture that I know the people in ThoughtWorks are talking a lot about. But I think it's also, how do you distribute the life cycle of dealing with data, from acquiring the data to processing the data and training models to deploying those models into your, you know, synthesizing them into your business processes and customer experiences. And I think that's where APIs are going to play a big role. Like, can you break down models into smaller models and use APIs as a way to kind of federate that? Can you break the life cycle down, and where can APIs help you acquire data and process data and really especially integrate them into your real-time operations? So yeah. I think that's a big.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That reminds me. We were talking last year. I can't remember the guest. We were talking about the idea of context as a key element in being able to. Yeah, Tiffany, that's right. To be able to take apply some kind of learning or some kind of intelligence to the analytics of the data that you have, right? So I think we're going to have to get a lot better at that. There's another thing that I don't think we talk a lot about yet, but I think we're getting to that point. One of the things, when I did this thing a few years ago where I talked about usability of data and how brains work and how we share information, one of the things our brains do, right, is they don't store every little bit of information that we've ever encountered. They store their version of it. And over time, we store it, and then we reinterpret those memories into other stories, into other things. And sometimes that actually changes the stored data in some kind of way. We consolidate every single day when we go to sleep at night. So I think we're going to have to figure out how to do the same kind of thing. It turns out having a huge volume of data doesn't actually improve the quality of it. There's a point at which having more is actually worse. So we're going to have to figure out how to create learning models that know how to create a context and then, you know, store that context and use just that context rather than use the raw data. Then, of course, we're going to have to deal with the idea that your context is not mine. Right. So now we're going to need enough sophistication to know that there are multiple contexts, multiple points of view, multiple ways to apply the same data. And I think it's going to be super, super interesting, as well as super challenging to start applying those kinds of ideas as well, right?
You know, Mike, I just want to thank you for explaining to me why it is I wake up in the morning having forgot everything.
Exactly, right.
Replaced the previous day.
There's a trick. Actually, going to sleep early improves your memory. Getting up late improves your creativity.
I don't do either one of those because I need room to binge watch and all those other things. But I just want to talk about the super practical, you know, intersection of APIs. I just want to respond to that APIs and big data and artificial intelligence. You know, one of the big promises of APIs is to create this, is to more easily create 360 degree view of some ecosystems of data. Let's call it cancer data, right? And one of the great benefits of, like you can pull together multiple databases, you know, reconcile some differences between them, get them into, you know, it's basically a virtual data warehouse when you've got APIs on like 50 different databases that contain similar data to create essentially a haystack in which you're looking for a needle, right? And the needle might be the cure for cancer or some pattern that leads to a cure for cancer. But it's not humanly possible to sift through that haystack. No human being can do it, which is where AI comes in. So I would just say there are some super practical instances of where people can use APIs to create that real-time source of, single source of truth across multiple data sets that were not, in the same physical Oracle database or something like that. And then also use APIs to access the artificial intelligence API, some sort of artificial intelligence capability, and sick it on that data in a way that surfaces some pattern or something that's interesting, whether it's a cure for cancer or some opportunity that's available to a business that they were overlooking because they just simply couldn't see it, the human beings couldn't find it themselves.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Edward Tufte line, which is big data will tell you whatever you want if you torture it long enough. It's all about context, right? It's like, if I'm looking for a needle, I bet you I'll find it if I use enough data, right? So these are all things we're going to have to deal with. And I think you're so right, David, in the notion that there are multiple sides to this. One is the APIs to actually have access to the volumes of data that we never had access to. This distributed data that Matt was talking about. And then there's the APIs that apply the machine learning, right? That can actually apply context and sort and sift at a speed that humans can't do, right? And it's just like we were talking about the creativity in issue with robotics and no code and low code. It's the creativity issue in thinking about how you think about a problem, how you structure the model. I think we're going to probably see, I don't know if it's, what the state of it is now, because I'm not active in the space, but modeling for learning is going to be a huge role in the organization, just like we've created elevated positions like the chief information officer and these other things. The people who apply context to large data they have access to, your ability to creatively context the same data that everyone else has is eventually going to be your way to beat your competition.
Yeah, we're and like I said, I mean the proof's in the pudding when you're looking at the organizations that are kind of on the front of the wave around digital. We kind of touched on this a bit, like the ethical issues around it too are there's immense, there's privacy of data considerations, and I think there's a lot about who does data ownership issues, how that relates to ethics and access. Tim Berners-Lee is doing some stuff around talking about kind of a future vision of the web where people are owning their data. Like, is that, have you heard of that?
Sure. Yeah. The whole Solid plan and Inrupt and these other things that he's dealing with. And then there's the whole notion of, learning by observing is not necessarily the best way to learn. If I happen to be using my context as something that's a negative context, applying that negative context to all this data is going to teach me things that I probably don't want to repeat, right? So we want to make sure we sort of stretch beyond what we observe in every day, and we start to create learning models about what we want to see. There are things, so many things that have to do with the way we use information to project a world, to create a world, to judge a world. And we're going to run into all of those as we start to apply AI to data.
So, yeah, and I think on the ethics front, to David's point, there's always two sides to everything, right? And so in some ways, AI can help us overcome our biases because, in the cancer research example, I know they've been using machine learning-based models to do diagnosis, and doctors have sworn up and down they made the right diagnosis, but then have been kind of checked by these AI models saying, actually, it's not the type of cancer you think. It's a different, which is a totally different treatment. I was reading a story on that recently. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it's also a place where we persist our own biases, right? So and I think maybe the API story there is the more that we're able to sort of decompose the complexity through, as a way of representing the structure of the complexity of the solutions we're coming up with, will maybe give us more insight into where those biases might be and just give us better understanding of this big complex system that we're building.
Absolutely.
Fascinating area.
Yeah, for sure. And fascinating discussion. And, who would have predicted it? We're three questions into the six. We're like 46 minutes into the podcast. I'm going to make a suggestion right here live on the podcast.
All right.
Let's close, make this a part one.
Okay.
And we'll come back, the three of us. We've got three more questions to ask, which I'm sure we'll be able to answer within 3 hours. No. we'll come back and do a part two for the remaining questions, which are just as thought-provoking. But at this point, thank you, Mike.
Yeah,
absolutely. And thank you, David.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not going to remember the questions because when I go to sleep tonight,
we'll be sure to provide ample context
very good.
But I'm really excited about our season two of the APIs Unplugged podcast. Thanks everyone for listening. We'll be back very soon with part two and look forward to sharing our thoughts then. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.